Hi, my name is Cecilia Aragon, and I am a computer scientist and researcher at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab in Berkeley, California. And today I'm going to talk about deploying a lightweight, context-linked event notification system for a distributed team and astrophysics collaboration. Next slide, please. I'd like to start out by thanking my collaborators, Sarah Poon, Roland Thomas, and Brian Lee, who worked with me at Berkeley Lab, and also the scientists of the nearby Supernova Factory collaboration, both in the United States and in France. Slide three, please. During this talk, I'm going to start out by discussing the initial problem that motivates our solution of context-linked tools. I'll define the term context-linked and explain why it was successful in solving some of the problems that a distributed team that was operating under time pressure needed to solve. I'll give some background on the astrophysics case study that we developed our tool for, and some background on the science and the study of supernovae and dark energy. Then I will discuss some of the operational challenges that one runs into when operating a large telescope remotely. And I'll discuss the design and implementation of our context-linked tool called BERT, which was integrated into the chat system that was already used by the scientists for communication during their collaboration. I'll give the results of a user evaluation we conducted of the benefits that BERT brought to the science collaboration. And finally, I'll conclude with a discussion of context linking, where it could lead us, and some future work. Slide four, please. So, one of the problems that we're facing in the world today is that data streams are becoming larger and more complex all the time. And at the same time, the teams that need to solve, the need to deal with these data streams and gain insight or knowledge from them are increasingly geographically distributed. Travel costs are being cut, and remote collaborations are becoming more commonplace. Some of these distributed teams are working under time pressure. For example, first responders, a team of pilots and air traffic controllers is always going to be geographically separated. Hospital staff could be in a time-critical situation and in some cases maybe geographically distributed, and in our particular case, astrophysicists operating large telescopes find that they are operating large and expensive equipment under time pressure, and the operation is being conducted by a geographically separated group of scientists that needs to make critical decisions in sometimes as little as 45 seconds. As many in this group probably know, software tools can greatly facilitate collaborative decision-making. But the question is, how do we design these tools? It's important that they be lightweight. In other words, they need to be low-cost, especially in today's days of shrinking budgets for scientists and other groups. And additionally, the barriers to entry must be low, because if you're a highly trained person working in a specialized system, you do not want a new system to be introduced unless it shows a clear benefit. Slide five, please. So among the challenges in developing these collaborative tools are, as I mentioned, the difficulty of gaining user acceptance of these custom tools. Additionally, the cost is critical. And especially in time-critical distributed control room situations, such as we're dealing with here, it's important that any event notification has just the right level of intrusiveness. For example, airline pilots need to be advised of safety-critical situations, but if there is a warning that provides too many false positives, they will just turn it off. And this is true in general of anybody who is cognitively overloaded. You must hit just the right level of intrusiveness so that important information is not ignored, and yet neither does it become annoying. Finally, it's important to integrate with whatever existing environment people are already using. So any software you develop should integrate very smoothly with the existing environment. Slide 6, please. As we were trying to decide what tools are important to develop for scientists, we looked at the aviation analogy. In fighter pilots and pilots using modern aircraft today have what's known as a head-up display. This is a translucent screen that is in front of the windshield, so that as the pilot is looking out at the world outside, symbology can be displayed on this translucent screen, and they don't have to lower their head, for example, to look at the altimeter or the airspeed indicator. They can keep their head up and out looking at the world. And there's been a lot of research in this area, and one of the things that was noticed is that sometimes this symbology could be very distracting and could actually distract the pilot from seeing things, important things that were going on in the world outside. So McCann in 95 proposed this idea of context-linked information for head-up displays. And what he meant by that was you want the information that you put on the head-up display to be integrated with the three-dimensional world outside. In work that I did previously, we were developing symbology that would tell helicopter pilots when there were airflow hazards. And what we did is that information would be placed on a head-up display, but it was integrated with the three-dimensional world outside. So it looked as though this symbology was outside in the scene. And that it dramatically improved their performance. So now that we're moving to the desktop world, we propose the idea of context-linked tools. And what we're doing here is we want both task and context information to be included in the shared communication space. And so task information is defined as information immediately pertinent to the job at hand that is involved, for example, in operating the telescope. And context is background processes, events in the environment, you know, such as when is sunrise coming, what are the winds doing outside the telescope, information such as that. Next slide, please. So we developed a lightweight, context-linked virtual assistant and event notification system that we called BERT. And this is a pseudonym, by the way. All names in this talk are going to be pseudonyms to protect the privacy of the people involved. This tool was actually integrated with a chat client that was already used by the collaboration for communication during remote telescope operations. So it satisfied the requirements that we mentioned earlier, that it has to be easy to use, low cost, and already integrated with the existing environment. This tool was developed for the nearby Supernova Factory, which is an international astrophysics collaboration and the largest data volume supernova search currently in operation. We process 50 gigabytes of image data per night, and we have a very time-critical telescope operation where at certain points decisions must be made in as little as 45 seconds. I'm not going to describe the entire very complicated system that we developed for the nearby Supernova Factory. I'm going to focus on just one piece, which is the remote telescope operation where we do spectroscopic follow-up of the supernovae. And I'm going to explain a little bit where that all fits in the next series of slides. So please go to slide 8. So just a little explanation of what we're doing. We are searching for supernovae, which are stellar explosions, and turns out that you can study these explosions and measure the expansion rate of the universe. And we can answer some very fundamental questions about the universe. Next slide. So there is a particular type of supernova called a type 1A. And these are some images of what they look like. They're these bright spots that appear near a galaxy. And as you can see, the supernova, when it explodes, can be as bright as a galaxy itself. However, they're very rare. This particular type of supernova will occur in a typical galaxy only once or twice per millennium, and it will only be bright enough for us to view for a few weeks. So they're hard to find, and they're very short-lived, so it's a very challenging research problem just to find where they are. Next slide, please. So just some background about why this question is interesting. When Einstein was doing his work on physics and cosmology, he realized that he had to put in what he called a cosmological constant lambda in his equations to get them all to balance out. Because otherwise, if you have a static universe, gravity is just eventually going to cause the universe to collapse. So he said, I'm going to say there's some kind of negative pressure in the universe that sort of keeps everything apart. But then shortly thereafter, Hubble discovered that the universe was expanding. And so Einstein said, the cosmological constant was my greatest blunder. So for the next 50 years after this, the question was, okay, we know the universe is expanding. Well, will it ever contract someday, or is it going to continue expanding forever? And so the assumption was that the universe is expanding, but it is slowing down. So although it's expanding slower and slower, and there's a deceleration rate. Then about 10 years ago, two groups independently, including one here at Berkeley Lab, discovered by measuring type 1A supernovae that the rate of expansion of the universe is actually accelerating. And this was a very shocking result in physics and astrophysics, and in the last 10 years, this is one of the great unsolved questions. Please go to slide 11. So the nearby supernova factory was designed in order to just collect more data, because the original sample that Reese and Perlmutter came up with their momentous discovery was only less than 100 of these type 1A supernovae, because they are really very rare. So the goal of the nearby supernova factory is just to collect as many as possible, just collect a large data set, reduce the statistical uncertainties on the equations of state of the universe. And this project has been in operation for about 3 years now, and it's almost finished collecting their supernova. They just passed 500 supernova spectroscopically typed just about a month ago. So please go to slide 13. So this is an overview of the supernova factory search data flow. We're starting up in the upper left-hand corner at Mount Palomar. There's a 1.2-meter telescope that actually takes wide-angle CCD views of the sky, and then we compare them with older images to see whether there are new bright spots. And this is all done on supercomputers here at Berkeley Lab. We run 24 hours a day. As soon as the images come in, we process about 30,000 images, 30,000 large images, and a total of about 500,000 potential objects each night. It's about 50 gigabytes of data that covers 500 square degrees of the sky. And we have image processing software and tools that humans can use also to check on the image processing software to discover which of these bright spots are actually potential supernovae. Once we find one, and typically we'll find one or we'll find about, you know, 5 or 6 possibilities a night, and we will send those to, this is down in the lower left-hand corner, where it says SNIFF's University of Hawaii 2.2-meter telescope. And this is the telescope that I'm going to be talking about in this particular talk. We have a dedicated spectrograph called SNIFF's, the Supernova Integral Field Spectrograph, that we use that was custom-built just to find... It was tuned just for these particular types of supernovae. But operating it on this telescope is actually a very challenging and complex operation, and that is what I will be describing in this talk. Next slide, please. We're on slide 14. So one of the things that I first discovered when I joined this collaboration was how challenging and interesting it is to operate a large telescope remotely. And there are actually some surprising parallels with operating jet aircraft. The astronomers who are manipulating the telescope have to monitor very complex, dynamic, operational data streams. I have a static image on a slide, I think, coming up right after this one. But it almost looks like an aircraft cockpit because there are all these lights flashing and moving back and forth. There are streams scrolling, and you have to keep track of all this. It's critical because this is a very expensive telescope with custom hardware, which often has failures and problems. The telescope can get stuck, filters or cooling systems can fail, and you need to be able to discover this right away, fix the problem. Additionally, there are important operational constraints, such as maneuvering limitations. With certain types of equipment that are on the telescope, you don't want to move the telescope. You know, the telescope can shift to cover the whole sky, which is a hemispheric dome above you. But if you take it too far down low, the equipment on the other end can bang into things. Also, it's not good for the delicate optics of the telescope to be exposed to sunrise, so you need to know when sunrise is approaching. Because the telescope is being operated remotely, you may not be aware of when sunrise is approaching. If you are on site, since you're up at altitude, you're prone to hypoxia or lack of sufficient oxygen to the brain, which will decrease your cognitive abilities. And if you're operating at night, that can also be a challenge in terms of human cognitive abilities. Finally, if adverse weather occurs, you may need to immediately close the telescope. And again, if you're operating remotely, you may not be aware of that. And as I said before, in our particular case, we need to make critical decisions in 45 seconds each night. Let's go to slide 15, please. So this is the image of operating the telescope remotely over VNC. This is a static image, so you can't see, you don't get the idea of what it's like. But imagine each of these little sub-windows, there are lights flashing on each one, the text is scrolling by, colored text means different things, there are different warnings you have to pay attention to, and you have to be running all these different scripts and making sure everything works correctly, and it has to be done in a time-critical fashion. Further, the people who are operating the telescope may be novices to this because, as you can guess, this is work that's done. It's done at night, and so, you don't often have the experts on hand because nobody can stay up all night every night to operate the telescope. So taking a shift is what we call it. This is the analogy of a factory that different people in the collaboration will sign up for different shifts to operate the telescope, and so they may not be as comfortable or as expert with all the different details of the telescope, which really require significant amounts of expertise to operate smoothly and efficiently. So you'll see in the lower right-hand corner of this window is an AIM chat client. The way the collaboration works is we use a shared VNC to operate the telescope and then communicate with each other via chat. Again, this is for, there are a couple of reasons why chat is used instead of the telephone. One is it's an international collaboration, and the cost of running an international telecon every night for 12 hours would be prohibitive, whereas the chat, of course, is lightweight, easy to use, and free of charge. Additionally, the chat is persistent, in that if you go away for a few minutes, you can come back and scroll over what has gone on in the chat, and if any critical events happen when you were gone, you won't miss it, and you don't have to disturb everybody by coming back and saying, what happened when I was gone? So for this reason, the scientists found using chat very helpful, and they adopted it pretty much right at the beginning of the project. Slide 16, please. Was there a question? Okay. We're waiting till the end of the talk to answer questions. Sorry about that. All right. Further challenges. Telescope time is really expensive, and as I said, the supernovae are rare and fleeting, so it's very important to come up with an optimal schedule every night for the maximum scientific benefit. However, there are often unpredictable variations in the schedule. If you have upper air turbulence, you're seeing the clarity of the data you're collecting from the sky won't be as good. Sometimes there can be fog or changing cloud cover. So you actually often will need to make changes in the schedule on the fly. So originally when the project was planned, the idea was that everything would be automated, and the person who was actually operating the telescope would just sit there and watch the automation go by. But as they found out very soon, that really never happens. There's always something that goes wrong, something that requires human intervention almost every night. Slide 17, please. Okay, so these are some other challenges here. We have a cross-cultural collaboration that's widely distributed. So the telescope is in Hawaii, but it is typically remotely operated by anywhere from 2 to 6 people on a given night, and these people will be on the west coast of the U.S. and the east coast, and also in France. It's important that these correct, time-critical decisions have to be made collaboratively, and we have to deal with cultural differences and language differences, and I'll talk a little bit about those a little later. Some team members have never met. I mentioned that many have some unfamiliarity with the telescope interface, and also that people's diurnal rhythms may be opposite from the telescope environment, especially if you're in France where they have an 11-hour time difference. Slide 18, please. So early in the collaboration, there were a number of difficulties that came up, and so BERT was developed as a lightweight virtual assistant that actually operates within the chat to assist with these time-critical science tasks and general awareness. And this is what I'll be talking about during this talk is the implementation of BERT and the user evaluation. So BERT has two main functions. One is just to announce relevant events, such as when an exposure has been completed, when the telescope has taken a spectrum of a particular target. That's announced. Also, the number of minutes till sunrise. That's a very important thing for general awareness or what we in the aviation business call situation awareness, just knowing what's going on around you. Additionally, BERT will respond to user queries for information. And BERT has actually been in operational use since 2005. Slide 19, please. So I want to talk a little bit about previous work in using chat in scientific collaborations and augmenting chat for various purposes. The concept of scientific collaboratories, or as William Wolf coined the term, it's a center without walls for scientists to work together. And some early work was done with studies of the Upper Atmospheric Research Collaboratory by Finholt and Olson and many other people, where they looked at what are the tools that are necessary for scientists to work together, and what advantages can scientists realize by various types of communication when they're trying to do scientific work. There's also recently been a lot of work on the use of chat, because since a lot of people use it and it's very convenient, there have been studies showing that it's actually an excellent grounding and orienting tool. It really helps keep distributed members aware of the status at the physical site. There was the Bim Holtz work in 2005 was they had an earthquake monitoring site, and they had remote collaborators who could then, who used the chat to find out what was going on right there at the physical site. And we've also found that to be true in our case. Chat can be used for troubleshooting. You can bring in a remote expert very easily to answer a technical question when it would be very hard to bring them in, physically. There have been studies using chat for distributed software development. Fitzpatrick et al. Came up with a ticker tape notification of CVS commits. So when code is checked into the central repository, this was found to be, again, very useful for grounding of the team in general. And finally, there's been a lot of work and studies done on the benefits of persistent chat. As I mentioned earlier, the combination of synchronous and asynchronous collaboration that can occur when you have a chat log is very, very valuable. And so our work here confirmed the values of that persistent chat, and I'll be talking more about that later. Slide 20, please. So BERT, as I said, it's a very lightweight implementation. BERT is written in Perl and uses just the standard CPAN modules. So almost everything here that's complex, we borrowed a tool from someone else. We use a lot of open source software, and the goal, there was zero budget for this, so this is just something that was written kind of as a side project at first, just to meet a need that the scientists saw. BERT communicates with a chat network via the OSCAR protocol that the AOL Instant Messenger system developed. So again, we're using a commercial existing system and just piggybacking on that. At startup, BERT connects to the chat network and finds the preset chat room, and then just listens and can accept connections from processes that are running on the Summit machine. And this is what we call there's a computer at the Mauna Kea Summit, which is where the telescope is located, the University of Hawaii telescope. And so any types of, direct operations that are going on with the telescope, BERT is aware of and then announces them in the chat. When a user wants to connect to BERT, all they do is they invite BERT to join the chat. So it's very simple. Slide 21, please. So event notification, as I said earlier, the programs just send their messages to BERT just via a very simple Unix file socket, and the at command is used to trigger a BERT message at a pre-specified time. Slide 22, please. So, again, this is very easy. BERT is very easy to use, really less than about 2,000 lines of code. So this is an extremely lightweight tool. We don't do very complex parsing. The tool just detects BERT's name in the chat, and so you say something like, BERT, where is the moon? And BERT will respond with the coordinates of the moon. The location of the moon is very important to astronomers because it's bright, and it will actually wash out the target supernovae, which are significantly dimmer, so you need to be aware of that. Other things such as humidity, where the telescope is pointing, and especially when sunrise is, are very critical for increasing the operator's general awareness of what is going on, both in terms of what they need to do their jobs and also what is going on in the environment. So actually the most common question when we evaluated Bert's, the chat logs with Bert is, Bert, when is sunrise? Because, sunrise marks two things. It's not just that it's that, you could damage the optics, by leaving the telescope uncovered when the sun comes up, but additionally it marks the end of the observing night, and, given that we always have a very tight schedule, oftentimes the shifters are called upon to change the schedule is generated automatically, which supernova targets you're going to be looking at, but often the shifter will need to change that. So they'll need to make a decision on the fly, and to do that they need to know how they can fit everything in and the important things in before the night is over. Additionally, a feature of BERT that the users really like is you can say SOS and then give the name of one of the experts. And this will actually call their cell phone and leave a text message on them and wakes them up in the middle of the night. And the on-call experts say, you know, we don't mind being awakened. We don't want to lose a night of observing, so please go ahead and do this. And it actually works out. It actually works out very well. People, you know, it's hard for somebody to remember who's on call now, you know, what's their phone number, how do we do it? But you just say, Bert, SOS, their name, and the person will, you know, usually comes in the chat a few minutes later, and then they can solve the problem. And that often makes a difference between a successful night of observing and one that's not successful. Slide 23, please. The user interface for BERT was developed through a process of cross-cultural user-centered design. For example, when BERT was first created, BERT didn't greet anybody in the chat, and the French collaborators started saying, oh, BERT is unfriendly. I come in the chat and BERT doesn't say hello to me. And so that was actually changed as a result. What was interesting is as BERT developed, BERT ended up being personified by a lot of the people using the chat. They call him a helpful little guy, and they say, oh, we like to make fun of him because, you know, so it's almost like he's become kind of a member of the collaboration in some ways, and it's sort of funny. But I think this is an important part of these types of tools, because if you think about a distributed remote team with cross-cultural issues, a lot of people haven't met each other, what are the ways that you build a team? Well, it's through these, you know, socio-emotional exchanges where we learn a little bit about each other, where we exchange humor. You know, this is a way to pass the time during the long night where there's a lot of tension. And the humor actually helps diffuse some of the tension that people often feel. And one of the humorous things that was added to BERT pretty early on is it turns out there's an ELIZA module. I don't know if any of you remember the ELIZA tool, but this was built by Weizenbaum in the 60s as a simulated Rogerian therapist. So BERT has an ELIZA mode where BERT will run the ELIZA program, and it seems kind of silly, but actually, you know, people enjoy doing this. And again, we see that it provides some needed defusing of the tension, because if you can imagine that here you are, you're a graduate student in France, you're required to operate this complex telescope where if you do something wrong, you know, you'll get a lot of approbation. And so what we found is that this sort of having this humorous side in here just helped people generally relax during the sometimes challenging task of operating the telescope. Slide 24. Different members of the collaboration use different tools. For example, a lot of the scientists use Mac laptops, and they operate. They'll be running the ship from home. I've actually even seen it happen during a collaboration party. And so it's very convenient that you can access it from anywhere. But if you're doing this from home, you might want to be doing something else, like eating dinner or doing various other work. And so what people often do is they use the iChatter speech synthesis module, so that anytime somebody types a statement in the chat, it actually is spoken out loud. And when we interviewed the scientists, we found out that this was very useful because they could be doing something else, and then what they would do is they would set Bert's voice to kind of a robotic-sounding voice, and then when they heard Bert's voice on the chat announcing something, that would remind them they need to come back and focus on their laptop again. I mentioned earlier that there was an automated instrument control system, AIC or AIC, and Bert is fully integrated with this system and announces all the events that go on in the system. Another advantage of using Bert is that since Bert is always on now, that means that the chat we can say that the chat is logged all the time. So otherwise, whenever somebody exited the chat, the logging would stop. So we found that the use of we keep the chat logs, and we've found them very useful for training purposes, both for having new people go back and look at what happened the night before, and as I'm going to talk a little bit later in more detail about how the senior scientists can discover problems that may be going on with somebody who's a little bit more unfamiliar. Slide 25, please. So the methodology we used for our user evaluation was, first of all, we started with an analysis of all these chat logs. We have 3 years of these logs, nearly 500,000 lines of comments, and that includes users, BERT, and system messages as well. And BERT comments are about 32% of the total. For this particular paper, we focused on the logs from April through December because that gives the current state of operations. And during this time period, we had 21 unique users and about 150,000 comments. We also interviewed 4 observers in detail, and 3 of them had been observing since before BERT's integration so that we could get some idea of how using BERT had changed observing practices. Slide 26. So we discovered there were several synchronous and asynchronous uses of the chat, which I'm going to describe in future slides. But I want to start with a brief comparison that we made with the pre-BERT chat logs. This was really perhaps the most important reason that we implemented BERT, because people would be confused about when sunrise was happening. I have a short section of one of the chat logs here. Again, these names are pseudonyms, but you can see people are talking. They're trying to figure out what time is it in Hawaii, and indicating that they are confused. And this was really a general problem when we looked at all the pre-BERT chat logs and interviewed the scientists who had done the shifting before BERT was implemented. This came up over and over again. They really didn't know when sunrise was going to happen, and it was very disorienting and made the job much more difficult. Slide 27, please. So now I'm going to list a bunch of categories of synchronous BERT use which were evident from the analysis of the chat logs. Collective decision-making was a very important and frequent use of BERT. Here we see 2 users of the chat asking questions and trying to decide whether they want to take another spectrum. And so they want to know, well, do we have time? And, where are we? And so they ask BERT, when is sunrise? Again, this common question. And you can see the response that BERT gives, not just when sunrise is occurring, but when 18-degree twilight and 12-degree twilight will be taking place, because each of these twilights indicates a certain light level of the sky, which means that certain observations can't be done. Slide 28, please. Collective troubleshooting is another big use of the chat logs, and where Bert was especially helpful. So Bert would always announce when the automated instrument control system had an error. And as soon as this happens, we see these two users, Chi and Steph, and Chi is a novice observer, and when he sees the error, he asks Steph, who is more senior, to log in, and then they communicate to try to figure out what exactly has gone wrong. And toward the end, Steph concludes the telescope is stuck. All right, in this particular case, we find out later that the telescope wasn't stuck, but oftentimes you'll see this type of collective troubleshooting in the chat logs, and Bert is always involved in these as well and is helpful. Slide 29, please. Three other important categories of synchronous BERT use are just keeping track of events. We'll often see that the users, after BERT announces something, will just make some comment to each other, just indicating that they understood what happened. Additionally, there are a lot of analysis discussions that occur after a BERT announcement. For example, I mentioned this 45-second time limit when the system starts up, runs a number of programs, and the user has 45 seconds to decide whether or not they're going to take a spectrum of the next supernova. So Bert gives the warning and says, be ready and be prepared to stop the system. All right. And in this particular case, they opened up a little window, and they saw there was no star in the window, so it would be a waste of time to take that spectrum. And so Chi ran this stop script, which stops the automated control system. And finally, as I mentioned before, humor is an important aspect of relieving the tension. Slide 30, please. Additionally, the asynchronous uses of BERT are very important for the collaboration. For one thing, as new users enter a chat during a night, they will scroll back over the logs and they'll see BERT announcements which provide critical context for them in trying to figure out what has been done during the night and where they can fit in and what they can do. Also, there is a shift change during the night, and so the new shift person will often need some orientation and grounding before they can pick it up. And number two here, training and increasing group knowledge is probably the most important asynchronous use. The senior scientists review the chat logs usually each night, and they'll often email feedback, which is really valuable in terms of learning how better to operate the telescope. And one of the issues in this collaboration was that the senior scientists didn't really realize how steep the learning curve was for non-experts and beginner shifters. And they would say, well, why? You know, they would see something, a problem that had happened the night before, and they would say, why didn't they do anything about it? The answer is obvious. Well, it was obvious to them, but they didn't realize that the shifter was really cognitively overloaded. Yet, these scientists, obviously you can't monitor the chat all night. It's just not physically possible. So they found that they could use the logs to unmask the training program, the training problems, and then send out email and educate people over time. And finally, these logs were very important. As we developed software and various collaborative tools, we analyzed the logs and used the comments and used the logs to inform our design and development. Slide 31, please. Could I have slide 31, please?
Online.
Okay. So we talked about the importance of context-linked information, and what we found was that by having BERT actually in the chat log, in the chat system, in the chat window, we had the group obtained awareness of task information such as eight notifications. You must make this exposure now, so this is a task job, and then contact information was also present right there in the same chat window. For example, time until sunrise, events that are going on. The context linking actually saved a significant amount of time, and I'm going to discuss a little bit more about this in future slides. Slide 32, please. So what we found is that context-linked information was a significant aid in communication in this type of time-critical collaborative work. BERT provided continuous environmental data that was always accessible to the shifters, and they could access it very rapidly. And given the time criticality of these tasks, you really don't have time, you know, even though you have a browser, you don't have time to pick it up, to search it, to go back to the manual and to try to find, you know, where are you in the manual and figure out what's going on. The user's awareness of time and the schedule was dramatically improved by the presence of this context-linked information. There was a significant reduction in coordination efforts to establish a common ground. We just saw that there was significantly less time spent figuring out what the states of tasks were. Again, this is very critical when working under time pressure. And finally, the advantage of this tool being lightweight and easy to use was seen over and over again. It doesn't require elaborate setup. Nobody needs to know anything. They set up the VNC, and then they bring up a chat window, and everything is right there. Slide 33. So some other advantages of context-linked information is that during time-critical work, we found that it really facilitates the task prioritization. The shifters instantly knew which of the targets they wanted to observe were more important. And they could then decide which is the most urgent task we need to complete. Also, it's so easy to ask for help. You know, they just ask BERT these questions, like when is sunrise, where is the moon, what is the telescope doing, and they don't need to know about where the manual is. They don't need to know where to look it up. It's much faster if you can just ask someone for help. Additionally, they have the option of, you know, SOSing an expert, again, very easily without looking anything up. Finally, the people who use voice synthesis find that it avoids overloading their visual bandwidth, and again, it is an aid in time-critical work. I've mentioned before the benefits that BERT is presented within this persistent shared communication space. So this really enables this very rich and asynchronous analysis of shared work, in that the senior scientists can see what's going on with BERT. They know exactly what the telescope was doing, and at the same time, these BERT comments are interleaved with the shifters' comments in the chat, where you can see their frame of mind. You can see whether they're nervous, whether they're worried, whether they're on top of things. And this was very useful in evaluating the existing process and improving it. Slide 34, please. So given that BERT and the use of context-linked information has been very successful, what are our further goals for research at Berkeley Lab? Well, we have several projects that we're hoping to continue with. One of the things that would be very advantageous is developing adaptive verbosity for BERT, because sometimes when the shifter is cognitively overloaded, they don't want to get a lot of long chat messages, and they scroll up past the window, and they don't see what they all are. So it would be nice to detect that and to see how the shifter is interruptible and change BERT's verbosity that way. Additionally, we have this 500,000 lines of chat logs. We want to do a more in-depth analysis, and that is actually planned. And finally, we're hoping to do controlled studies on the effects of context-linked information in distributed teams. This idea of context linking is new, and we feel that it has been very beneficial, but it would be, of course, it would be very nice to do some controlled studies to really see whether the benefits that are accruing to us are due to BERT being a context link tool. Slide 35. Okay, so this is just the acknowledgments. I wanted to thank all the scientists that helped us with and thank our funders, the Department of Energy and the Moore Foundation. May I please have slide 36?
Oh, Cecilia, thank you very much. Excellent presentation. Now it's time for some questions.